This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, Crossover Podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What up, Beck?
What up, Mannix? How you doing, man?
You know, I think we should open every podcast with a hard reversal of positions on the Knicks. You know, last week we were like, oh, no, we shouldn't get too ahead of ourselves. You knew this was going to happen. As we record this, the Knicks, two in a row, they beat two playoff teams, the Celtics and the Magic, break up the Knicks. They're hovering around 500. Tom Thibodeau, coach of the year. Beck, we were wrong last week.
But we were right the week before then, or then we were right and then we were like, I don't know how this works. And you know what? If we keep this up, at a minimum, we'll be like batting 50%, I think. I like the perspective our friend Tommy Beer had on Twitter a little while ago, where he said, listen, Knicks fans, if the season ended today, Knicks would be sixth, I think, in the East or something like that. So miss out on the lottery pick. But we'd still have a lottery pick. And then he's got a screenshot of the standings, and they're down there in lottery range, circled as the Dallas Mavericks. Like that is a perfect encapsulation of Knick fandom, right there. We're gonna freeze this moment in time. We're gonna get the Mavericks lottery pick. We're making the playoffs. I love it. Look, if we are going to ride this roller coaster with Knick fans all year, Chris, we could just open every episode of this pod with, we're doomed, we're never winning again, or start the parade. Because it's one or the other. But that's the beauty of New York. It's a fun ride.
Knicks fans ebb and flow with every single game, and they've got to be feeling pretty good about themselves right now. Okay, on this episode, we're going to talk about the early returns with the James Harden Nets. Kyrie Irving spoke to the media for the first time in a couple of weeks. We'll kind of dive into what he said. The Clippers, are they for real this year? Paul George playing like an MVP candidate. And the Houston Rockets, did they get enough for James Harden? I want to talk about that and a little bit more. But Howard, let's begin with Brooklyn. And the Nets now 2-0 in the James Harden era. And it's gone about as well as you could expect it to go. James Harden, triple-double in his first game in Brooklyn. He and Kevin Durant look like they've picked up right where they left off. In the Oklahoma City days, playing extremely well off each other. Joe Harris has been kind of exactly what you want Joe Harris to be, a floor-spacing wingman who is knocking down shots at a pretty high clip over these last couple of games. I don't think you could be any happier, Howard, if you're a Nets fan with what you've seen from James Harden. What do you think?
Yeah, probably you couldn't be any happier if you were Steve Nash or Sean Marks or Kevin Durant either. This is what you wanted. This is what you hoped for. Harden looks really good. And it's funny watching these screenshots flow through Twitter of Rockets Harden versus Nets Harden, and people immediately, like, they're finding the least flattering angle possible to make it look like he was the Goodyear blimp in Houston, and the most flattering view possible to make it look like he magically slimmed down to a human pogo stick in Brooklyn. Pogo stick, by the way, preferred method of transit in Brooklyn. So I don't know about the magical transformation of his body. I do know that James Harden is playing at a really high level. The usage rate's still really up there, but that's because there's only two of them right now, not three. And so, you know, for all of the great early returns through two games, however much stock you want to place in that, the key to the Nets is not could Harden and Durant excel at a high level together. That you could take that as a given, not just because they played together before, but because that is the usual formula. Two high usage guys, fine. It's the third high usage guy, Kyrie Irving, that you have to worry about. And we'll get to Kyrie, I know, later in this pod. But I don't know that we can draw any fast conclusions or any conclusions at all until we've seen Kyrie Irving in the mix. I also think that ultimately this team is not done, Chris. They traded Jared Allen, their best center. They're now playing a lot of DeAndre Jordan. In fact, let me hit a couple. Let's shift straight to where their concerns might be two games in. because Harden and Durant look spectacular. There's nothing to discuss there. They look great. They're fine. But before the trade, they had eight players averaging 20 minutes a game. Now, that includes Spencer Dinwiddie, who's out for the season, but still. Eight players averaging 20-plus minutes, 10 players who were averaging at least 18. In the two games they've had since the trade with Harden, six players averaging 20-plus minutes, and only six who are even averaging 18 or more, and they've only used nine guys. In the midst of all that, DeAndre Jordan's minutes per game have gone from 18 minutes pre-trade to 30 minutes a game. I don't know if that's the ideal usage of DeAndre Jordan, who hasn't averaged 30 minutes a game since the 2017-18 season in LA. Jeff Green's gone from 20 minutes a game to 30 minutes a game. That would be, for a full season, would be his highest since the 2014-15 season. Bruce Brown, who I think they acquired for a cup of gourmet coffee, went from 15 minutes a game to 22 minutes a game. All their depth is gone. We know this. Some of this will change when Kyrie is back in the rotation. But Chris, I think the concern should be that they don't have any depth at all right now, and they're relying a ton on DeAndre Jordan and Jeff Green, and they're going to have to find some hidden gems along the way, whether it's the buyout market, whether it's the G League, whether it's another trade. I don't know. But I do think if we're going to throw up some early warning flags to go along with the early signs of yay, they look spectacular and they look like a team that can make a run – then it is that aspect of it. It's the rotation, it's the depth, it's the minutes that certain guys are playing.
Yeah, I don't know what the buyout market's going to look like this year. Honestly, I don't. You know, with it being such a quirky season, and I mean, there are a lot of teams that probably think they have a chance of getting into that play-in tournament, so that might, you know, reduce the buyout market organically because of that fact. I do agree with you. The front court, the depth, it's a problem. I don't think that a Jeff Green, DeAndre Jordan rotation in the front court is enough. I don't know what they do about it unless there is somebody in the G League that you can poach and add to that mix. But I don't know how that's sustainable. And I'm watching the game on Monday against Milwaukee, and I'm watching like DeAndre Jordan chase around Giannis on the perimeter. Like that's not going to work. Like that's not going to be effective. Now, there's an argument to be made, and a couple of GMs, you know, texted me this, or assistant GMs really texted me this during the week, where it's like, you know, they don't got to be a top 10 defense. Like, they're going to outscore you by a lot. Like, so you got to be able to keep up with their offense if you play the Nets. They've just got to be kind of, you know, mediocre, middle of the pack, 15 to 18 type of range to be successful. So maybe they can get there, but that front court depth, it absolutely worries me. I don't know what you do with the Jordan, you know, Jeff Green front court and how you flesh that out. I will say, watching Harden Durant, man, it's just fun. I mean, you knew that James Harden was not the kind of guy that was sulking his way through the first couple of weeks in Houston, that, you know, that it was more about he didn't want to be there than what he was as a player, even what kind of condition he was in. I mean, he's playing, you know, for a guy that's not in shape, he's being rolled out there for 40 minutes a game in his first two games. So he's clearly in enough condition to play at that type of level. But you know, if you're Steve Nash, you can just do so many things with those two offensive. You got two lethal three-point shooters in Durant and Harden that can create their own shots, that can play make. I mean, I love what I've seen from Harden, the playmaker. We'll get to this with Irving, but I mean, if Harden goes into every game with the attitude that I'm going to be a playmaker first and get my buckets when I need to get them, I don't know how you stop that offense. I mean, if you're a team going up against them, you're probably hoping that, you know, chemistry issues derail them, that it's a lot of your turn, my turn. But Harden can change all that by being a playmaker. And he is a brilliant passer naturally. So that's a great sign if you're Brooklyn. I just think that dynamic has the potential to be really special, not just this season, but in the years to come.
No, you're right to flag or to note Harden's passing. His passing was notable, to say the least, in the first couple of games. And yes, he still shot a lot and still scored a lot, which is what you come to expect from him too. But as we know, James Harden became an MVP in this league and a perennial MVP candidate because of more than just his scoring. It's not just the three scoring titles. He has been an elite passer as well. And though he has a high usage rate, and though to critics and to people who don't necessarily like the style of ball he was playing in Houston, will always hone in on how much he dominates the ball, how much he's dribbling. And yes, it can be tedious. It doesn't eliminate or does not detract from the fact that he is also an elite passer. What he's choosing to do at any given time in the game might vary. And there are going to be times when it feels like he is dominating the ball too much. That's a fair criticism of him, but he can do that. And in the same game, still have 12 to 15 assists, in part because he has the ball in his hands all the time. He completely, the entire offense revolved around him in Houston. It won't to the same extent in Brooklyn. And again, that's the curiosity here. We have not seen anything from Harden or Durant in these first two games that we wouldn't have already known or expected. The question is still going to be, what happens when you throw Kyrie into the mix? And how does Steve Nash calibrate? How often are those three on the court together? How often is it just two of them? Because the luxury for the Nets now is going to be, even when their second unit's on the court, their second unit might have, will have at least one of those two guys, or one of those three guys, and might have two of them. Think about what that does to another team's second unit. Other second units might just get blown off the court. And granted, again, to my earlier point, the Nets' depth isn't that great. But when a second unit is anchored by Kyrie, or Kyrie and KD for part of it, and Kyrie and Harden for another part of it, however you stagger those three, you're always going to have one and possibly two of them on the court. That's an incredible luxury, and that does lift up everybody else, because all three of those guys are great passers, especially obviously Harden and then Kyrie. So they will get guys better shots than they would otherwise. So it'll make some of those role players look better than they would. But we should note, before we leave the topic of the minutes, which I was talking about earlier, Harden averaged 40 minutes in those first two games, and Durant averaged 38. That is not sustainable. You do not. Maybe you want Harden playing his way into shape with at 40 minutes a game, fine. And Harden's been really durable in his career. Durant, lest we forget, is in his first season since Achilles surgery. I don't think that 38 minutes per game, even over a two-game stretch, is ideal, but that's where they are right now, and that's what they needed to win those games. And so, again, early success with Harden there, and I think some early, I don't want to make too big of a deal of it, but they're warning signs, some early warning signs to go with it.
Yeah, and if you're Steve Nash, you know, you might have to start trusting some guys a little bit more, whether it's Landry Shamet, who only played 11 minutes in the game against Milwaukee. You look at the bench. I mean, Bruce Brown was the leader in minutes in that game with 22. I think maybe you have to kind of roll the dice and hope that the talent that you have, you know, on the floor at all times, whether it is Kyrie, Harden, or Durant, you know, you can get by playing some lesser guys, you know, some minutes in those situations. Look, it doesn't, I mean, look, you've seen, like, Lou Williams has led second units being just a ball dominant scorer. You really only, when you have to go in with the second unit, oftentimes all you really need is one guy that can fill it up. Lou Williams has done it. Jamal Crawford has done it. In Utah right now, Jordan Clarkson is doing it. So I think you can get away with going deeper into that bench with more inexperienced guys as long as you have one of those top-tier guys on the floor. And it probably will pay dividends later in the season, in the playoffs, when these guys are not as burnt out. Because I'm with you. Durant at 38 minutes per is... Even if he was fully healthy, I wouldn't want to do that, to a guy at this stage. All right, let's talk about Kyrie Irving now. Irving on Tuesday had his first press availability in about 2 weeks. Talked about a lot of different things, or at least was asked about a lot of different things. One of the things that I took away from this, Howard, was what I thought was something of a lackluster response that Irving had when asked about the dynamic between himself, Kevin Durant, and now James Harden.
Like I said, it's just really exciting, you know, just to be able to play with great players that have, you know, just been here in the league for a while, have been through ups and downs, the peaks and valleys. So, you know, James is aligned with us in terms of just experience, and, adding that to our locker room is going to be great for us.
I mean, Irving, and you watched that availability, Howard, the body language wasn't great throughout. You know, he just didn't seem interested in being there at all and talking about anything about the last couple of weeks. Should I have been looking for more excitement there from Kyrie Irving? Like, should I have been expecting, like, man, oh, I'm part of a super team again? Or, you know, one of my takeaways was, you know, look, this is, you know, Kyrie's issue in Cleveland and Boston was that he was in or one of his issues anyway, he was in situations that were not of his choosing. Like, he was drafted by Cleveland, and then he was part of something for a couple of years, and then LeBron comes in, and he's a part of something different. Now, that resulted in a championship and, what, three straight trips for him to the NBA Finals, but I always felt that was something that bothered him, that it was a situation out of his choosing. He gets traded to Boston. He liked it early on, didn't like it so much as the end, and then he goes to Brooklyn and chooses to go back home to the New York City area, chooses to play with Kevin Durant. And then 2 weeks into the season, 3 weeks of the season, whatever it is, all of a sudden that team looks a lot different than what it was going to look like when Kyrie got there. I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into it, Howard, but that was one of my first thoughts that, all right, here's Kyrie now in a situation that he did not choose to be in. And how is he going to react to that? Is he going to embrace it, or is he going to sulk his way through it?
So I totally get all that, Chris. And I watched his presser. It was 12 minutes long, which, you know, that's a pretty good long time for a guy who probably, and by his body language, certainly seemed like he did not want to be there. And I don't mean be there with the Nets. I mean be there in that press conference on Zoom. He was, you know, very, you know, emotionally kind of flat. His most expansive and most interesting answers, I think, had more to do with where he is emotionally and mentally, how he's feeling about kind of just his place in the world. And I mean that earnestly, not facetiously at all. Like, he had some really interesting thoughts just as he was trying to semi-explain himself in a very ambiguous way, of course. And he did not offer any specifics about his absence and about his return. And I don't think he owes any of that to us. He owes it to his teammates. And he says he has delivered that. They know where he's at. They know what's going on. I'll take that as a given. But it's hard to judge him, Chris, on the apparent lack of enthusiasm about the partnership with Harden and Durant and this super team that they've just created, because his energy level was the same throughout the entire call. And I think it reflects that he is in a different place right now. Whatever was going on with him the last couple of weeks that made him decide to be away from the Nets, it's clearly still with him. Whatever has been weighing on him, he is still processing. And it's easy for people to make light of it. I saw a bunch of that happening in my timeline on Twitter today. It sucks. I hate seeing that. People, you know, listen, like, I understand Kyrie's a really easy target. And to an extent, he has made himself that with things he has said and done over the years. And on the basketball side, it's fair. On the personal side, we don't know. We never know. And even those of us who cover the league, and even when we think we know guys, and Kyrie's not someone who's as easily knowable, even the guys we think we know, there's often a lot going on that we don't know. I don't know what's going on with Kyrie, but I felt for him in watching that 12 minutes unfold today. I felt like, my God, this is a guy who something's going on. And I don't mean it to like some serious, scary way. I just mean, this seems like somebody who is really still processing something. And you saw him rub his eyes a couple of times. Not that he was getting teary or anything, but he rubbed his eyes a couple of times. He, you know, was leaning on his arms as he was speaking into the Zoom camera. I felt for him, to be honest, Chris. Like, I all I felt was empathy. I don't know what he's going through. I don't know what's still weighing on him, but something is. And we don't live in a very empathetic world, and certainly sports, the way that fans react, and when it feels like a guy has let you down, or you think that he's flaked out on his team or whatever, I understand like people's reactions there, but I think people should maybe try to take a step back. There were things he said, and I'll read off some of what I transcribed in a minute, but like, there were some things he said that I just thought were really interesting that had nothing to do with basketball. And I think that's the thing to your question. It's harder to know what to make of his feelings about the basketball side of things and Harden being there and where that leads them. And yes, he was flat in responding to that, but he was kind of flat in responding to a lot of things. There's clearly something else that he's got going on right now that is bigger than all that. And I think that makes it hard for him to be, you know, projecting any great enthusiasm about the Nets.
I think that's certainly possible. My feelings on Kyrie's absence are conflicted by the video, right? Like,
yeah.
If he had been out of sight, you know, my take on it would have been, I don't know what's going on with him. You know, mental health is a real thing. You gotta, you know, you can't just make assumptions, judgments on what's going on in the world of a person, you know, what events have an impact on a person. But it's hard to buy into that fully, Howard, when that video surfaces, which clearly was Kyrie at a birthday party, breaking NBA protocols. I mean, he sees what's going on, not just in the NBA, but in the world. And there he is at an event without a mask, with presumably more than the 15 allotted people that the NBA says you're allowed to have. I mean, that's, regardless of what's going on in your life, that's just plain wrong, man. Like, that's wrong on a public level. Like, you know, that's dangerous to be doing stuff like that. Because what happens, and this is like one of those what ifs, but what happens if that video doesn't surface? Does Kyrie come back? Does he jump right back in the locker room? Is there a potential for infection? I mean, we are seeing across the league, Howard, bad infection rates. You know, it's not a enormously high number of teams that are infected with COVID, but the teams that are just getting ravaged. Like the Washington Wizards right now, it's like every day there's a new player or staffer that pops, to the point where we're just kind of wondering when they can practice again, much less get back into a game. It's just, for me, that's hard to reconcile. I you know, Kyrie doesn't want to talk about what's going on in his life. That's his prerogative. As you said, he does not owe us in the media anything. That video, though, makes it really hard to kind of justify that absence completely and to accept that, you know, it was just, you know, his own personal business.
Yeah. And that's the thing, right? Like, I understand that. And I understand for a lot of people, when they saw the video of him at a party and he's smiling and seemingly having a good time, then it's, well, wait a minute, hold on. There's something that's so serious that you needed to take time away from the team, but you can be seen on video at, you know, restaurant, club, whatever it was, having a great time. But listen, like, again, I don't want to make excuses for him because I don't know. And I don't want to go too far with this, but we all have these moments in our lives, right? Where there's something else that's weighing on us, but that doesn't mean that we are dour 24/7. We still have those moments of levity or if, you know, we're having a tough time with things, but a friend has a party that we go to, we perk up for a little bit. Like, it, these things are not necessarily in conflict. It seems that way, and it does leave a bad impression. And I get why people react to it that way. And if they want to judge, they can judge. We still don't know the whole big picture, and we might never, and we don't have to. But I thought that Kyrie, to the extent that he was vague about things, it's hard to draw too much meaning from this, but he was clearly trying to express some things today. And while we don't have details, I still think these things were interesting and worth people considering. So here's a couple things he said on that Zoom call today, Chris. He says, as you can see, there's a deeper level of emotions that I have for helping and serving people around the world. He was talking a lot about this, about his place in the world and the things he wants to do that are outside of basketball and being somebody who helps and serves, right? And so,
and to be clear, Howard, before you finish the quote there, he was kind of walked into this stuff. Like, people were asking, it wasn't like he was volunteering, you know, what he wants to do outside of basketball. Like, you know, when the reporters asking calls on the questions realized 2 minutes in that he wasn't going to get into any of the stuff they really wanted to
get
answers for, they tried another way around it, which was,
right,
you know, I understand that. I've done that too. You have, like, try to get him to talk about a subject by talking about something else.
Yeah, no. The thing that was very clear from the get-go, and yes, you're absolutely right. He was not going to talk about why he left. He was not going to give details on what he told his teammates or how much communication he'd had with the team. When Malika Andrews of ESPN asked him about, did you know you were in violation of protocols regarding COVID? He kind of skipped past that one. So yeah, he was not going to engage on the fundamentals of the things that people have been talking about the last couple of weeks. Anything that what it might have been remotely controversial or that might have given insight into what's going on specifically, he ducked. But as reporters tried to get him to just open up about how, where he's at overall, I thought that's where it got interesting. Actually, there was another one. I'd forgotten about this. So Christian Winfield from the New York Daily News asked him, and this was a couple minutes in when it was clear that Kyrie was looking and sounding kind of flat and wasn't going to engage on anything. And Christian asked him, listen, you know, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, physically, is everything okay with you? And Kyrie did not have a verbal answer. He just kind of nodded. And I thought that was really interesting and telling. And again, one of those moments where I just thought, man, I hope he's okay. Like I did, like he nodded as if to say, yes, everything's okay, but I'm not convinced. Like I don't want to be dramatic about this, but just as a person watching another person answering that question and given his body language and his expression, I felt like, man, I hope he's okay. The reporters asked him about buying the house for George Floyd's family. And Kyrie said, you know, I'm just trying to do my part. He talked at one point about, quote, feeling the weight of the world. And again, I don't know if that's about this moment we're in as a country or as a society, whether that's the pandemic, whether that's what's going on politically, all of it. But he's got some things that are weighing on him. But it put him in, you know, this line of questioning put him in a reflective mode. And he said at one point, now that my life has changed, and I don't know if that means about his NBA career or in general, says with that change comes accepting that there are older versions of me that I didn't necessarily like, or things I would like to do different, or conversations I would like to have with different people to address, just have honest talk. And so like that's as reflective as I think we've heard from him. He's saying like, yeah, there are versions of me I don't like looking back and you know, things I'd like to do over. He says at one point, and this is important too, there's nothing normal about the life that I live. It's just something I've come to accept and embrace as let me use this as a tool to be able to change things that I want to see in the world. And Chris, I flagged that one and transcribed that one in particular because like none of these guys, when they're basketball prodigies or athletes in general, they don't sign up to be celebrities, right? They do this because they're great at the sport and they want to pursue that to the fullest. And yes, with that comes wealth and fame and all kinds of things and all kinds of opportunities, but not everybody is equally comfortable with it or embraces it. And not everybody handles it the same way or is as good at handling it. And some guys can struggle with it. And we've seen that over the course of history. So to me, again, that was Kyrie saying, by saying there's nothing normal about this life I lead, like he's saying, like I didn't choose fame and fortune. I chose to be a great basketball player, and this all came with it. And now I got to deal with it, and with all my own missteps, which he acknowledged a couple times making on this call.
Yeah, it was a really interesting call, or interesting, you know, kind of to watch him on a lot of different levels. I would say, I mean, look, for putting aside everything, you know, the one, it's just so hard to speculate on what's going on in his world. I just, as I watch it, I just kept going back to the basketball and wondering how it would fit. Because that's really all we can do at this point is look at kind of how this all makes sense. And I kept going back to what I was referencing a couple of minutes ago, that, you know, look, the Cavaliers were a championship level team with a, you know, they went back to the finals the year after Kyrie left, and Kyrie forced his way off that.
Yeah.
Like he wanted nothing to do with being part of that championship level team. Boston was a little bit different because of the toxicity that formed in the locker room during that 18-19 season. But they were, if Kyrie had come back, they were, you know, potentially a championship level team. They are right now, you know, with by flipping Kyrie for Kemba Walker effectively with that group. He walked away from that. I just couldn't help but think that, you know, maybe Kyrie has a good relationship with James Harden. It's not one I'm aware of at this point, outside of, you know, all-star games and the usual circles that stars run in. But I just couldn't help but think, like, you know, is Kyrie going to want this? You know Durant wants this.
Yes.
You know James Harden wants this. I don't know if Kyrie wants this. And that could be a real warning sign if I'm the Nets. I mean, he's going to be back. He's going to play. But if they're not in lockstep with each other, then they're beatable. They're very they're beatable already because of their defense and their lack of depth, which we already talked about. But if Kyrie throws a wrench into this by him not wanting to be there, that's potentially a looming problem that I think is going to reveal itself.
Yeah, fair. whether that's about the basketball, whether that's about the things going on with him off the court, whether it's about all of that wrapped together, I don't know. But I will say, yeah, I think if I were taking this just as a basketball matter, if I were running the Nets, if I were the coach of the Nets, his emotional tenor during that press conference did not project a guy who was excited about the opportunity in front of him. And maybe that, you know, that it, there may be good reasons for him not to have that energy or that emotional like burst right now. And maybe it comes later, Chris. Maybe he's still working through whatever's going on in his life. And maybe as these days and weeks unfold, he'll get back to being the Kyrie Irving that we're used to seeing, not just as a basketball player, but emotionally. Today, I don't know what to make of that. And does he truly embrace this three-way partnership now with Durant and Harden? Like, he chose Brooklyn with KD. The point of the exercise a year and a half, almost 2 years ago, was the two of them teaming up in Brooklyn. It wasn't a three-man thing. And now it is. And Harden and Durant have a relationship that, as you point out, Kyrie and Harden, to our knowledge, does not have. Is that making him feel differently about it? I don't know. It bears watching, put it that way. It absolutely bears watching. And, you know, look, by this time tomorrow, the Nets will be back on the court with Kyrie in the mix, presumably, by all indications. And we'll see soon enough how well those three work together.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Certainly one of the more compelling storylines as the season goes forward. All right, let's talk about the Rockets for a minute here. Raphael Stone, the general manager of the Rockets, he spoke to the media this week and addressed, what the Rockets received for James Harden. They get Victor Oladipo, an all-star caliber player who they're obviously excited about. But here's Raphael Stone talking about kind of what he liked most in this deal for James Harden.
I will say what's super exciting about this deal is it gives us flexibility in the NBA. Picks, especially high picks, are the best currency. Everybody likes them. Everybody values them. So that was great organizationally. It gave us flexibility to do different types of deals as they come up this year, next year, whatever. And then we were able to get Victor Oladipo as part of it, along with Rhodey and Dante. But Victor's a guy we're really excited about. And I think he's excited to be here and we think he's very talented. And so that was not insignificant from our perspective.
So I hear that, Howard, and I hear a general manager excited about the flexibility and the possibility that comes with acquiring a whole bunch of draft picks. And I'm telling you, I just scratched my head a little bit watching that. We discussed this last week, in the aftermath of the trade. I'm of the belief that you can't bank on draft picks. You can't sit there and say, we got all of Brooklyn's picks, and now we're going to wait for Brooklyn to implode, just like they did in 16, 17, and 18 when the Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce trade just went down the hill. The Nets, look, I don't know what they're going to look like 4 years from now, but right now, they look really good. It's more likely than not that they have at least Harden and Durant in a Nets uniform for the next 4 or 5 years. And that's probably going to make them a pretty good team, barring anything crazy happening. There's a possibility, I said this last week as well, I'm going to repeat myself here. There's a possibility that all the Rockets get out of this James Harden deal are four picks in their 20s. That would be the three Nets pick and the Milwaukee pick that they picked up from Cleveland. There's a possibility that Oladipo could walk, either because he wants to go somewhere else, so the Rockets couldn't afford to sign him. There's a possibility, maybe even a likelihood, that those swap rights are meaningless. Swap rights are only meaningful when the team you're swapping with is worse than you. And the Celtics benefited greatly from that, from the implosion of the Nets. They got Jaylen Brown, they got Jason Tatum, they got their core because the Nets stunk out the joint. If these Nets don't stink out the joint, those swaps are meaningless. So, I don't know. I mean, you can't predict the future. And maybe those four picks turn into Pascal Siakam, Tony Parker, and every other great pick that's been taken in the 20s over the last 20-plus years. But not taking a deal headlined by Ben Simmons, man, that seems like a real roll of the dice. I'm not saying Ben Simmons is perfect. He's certainly a flawed player, but he is a perennial all-star who's 24 years old, who's under contract through 2025. I'm not going to be convinced that this kind of mystery bag that the Rockets are holding out here saying this is what we have is better than that. I can't get on board with that. What say you?
If you're a Rockets fan, if you're Rafael Stone, if you're Tillman Fertitta, you're absolutely looking at what the Celtics got from the last time the Nets made a deal of this nature and saying, wow, what if we get our Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum? But that's a big if. And the Celtics had a couple whiffs in there too.
That's like saying it was a small iceberg, Howard. Like it's a massive if, okay? It's a huge if. Like that was a confluence of events that may not happen ever again for a team to get that type of return.
And by the way, you remember what the very last piece of that I think it was the very last piece of that return was?
I mean, they moved those picks down the line so often.
I think the very last pick in that whole batch was the one that they sent to Cleveland for Kyrie Irving, which became the number 8 pick overall, which became Colin Sexton. So and by the way, part of the reason that happened is because Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson were really good at their jobs. And by the time they got this team, you know, back in a certain direction, started rebuilding again and overachieving, they ruined that pick. Like that last pick was supposed to be a golden ticket type pick. And when the Cavs got it for Kyrie, they thought we made a phenomenal trade. We not only got Isaiah Thomas, Jay Crowder, we got this pick. We got the Nets pick, the golden ticket. It ended up being the 8th pick, which most years is a crapshoot at 8. So if Sean Marks and his front office are as inventive and as great at scouting a couple of years from now or along the way as they were in cleaning up the last Nets disaster, then they might ruin whatever picks the Rockets are getting too. Sean Marks has done a good job of that already once. So there's that. Yeah, of course you want Ben Simmons instead of picks. Like,
they didn't. But like, but you say, of course, but they didn't. I don't get this. I can't wrap my head around this. Like, you know, a couple of reporters in Houston tried to walk Rafael Stone towards that to say, you know, what about a better player in that mix? And and understandably, he wouldn't go there. But I need to hear something, man. I need to hear why a Ben Simmons straight up wasn't as good as those picks. I just got to figure it out.
I said many times up in the weeks leading up to the trade, and you probably did too. If Ben Simmons is on the table, it's game over. I truly believe that. I thought if the Sixers were willing to part with Ben Simmons, there's no other discussion to have. There's no better player you're going to get. I don't even care what else is in the deal from Philly's side of it. If you can get a top 15 player in his early prime, that's what you do, period. They didn't do that. The reporting suggests, I don't have this verified myself. And I always say, like, I think it's hard to nail down what teams really would or wouldn't have done when push comes to shove. Was it really about including Tyrese Maxey or not? Was it really about including Thibel or not? I don't know where it broke down. And I don't want to assume with 100% certainty that Ben Simmons was truly on the table. But if he was, then I think absolutely that's the deal you make. And even if you think, well, we have John Wall, and John Wall's really hard to move.
Well, Howard, can we quickly stipulate that Ben Simmons was on the table? Like, you're not having a conversation with Philadelphia that goes as far as it went over, like, Tybal, Maxey, and 10 first-round picks. Like, you're just not doing that. Like, it's not a question to me if Ben Simmons was on the table.
All right, let's
it's
just
a
stipulate.
What was around Ben Simmons.
Ben Simmons is on the table. A very big table because he's a tall guy. He's on the table, and if your struggle is try to figure out, well, does he fit with our current guys, or does he fit with John Wall, or what do we do next, then I think you've already erred. You've already made a mistake, because the goal when you're having – like, it's not that they woke up and decided to trade James Harden, but the goal of trading a superstar like Harden is to get the best possible return, and I think that means talent, and to your point, not the – bag of magic beans of the picks that may or may not become something down the road. And if you don't think Ben Simmons fits, if you don't think you can build quickly enough around him, and there's a case to be made, hey, he doesn't fit with the guys we have now. How long would it take to actually build something around him? Is he going to sour in the meantime? And then he's going to demand a trade somewhere else or whatever. Fair. There are some logistical concerns the day that you get him. I say you figure it out. I say you figure it out. And if you don't think you can figure it out, then while you're acquiring Ben Simmons, you're immediately trying to figure out who really wants him and what they're willing to give up. Because Ben Simmons is worth a ton and would be worth a ton to a lot of teams around the league. And so if you don't think you can use him because you're married to John Wall or because you don't think you can reformat the lineup around him to maximize him quickly enough to make it worthwhile, fine. He's still worth a shit ton. Get something else for Ben Simmons. Get the package. If the Sixers had woken up yesterday or tomorrow and said, we're going to trade Ben Simmons, think about what they could get for him. So, you know, Chris, it's hard not to think about what the Pelicans got for Anthony Davis and what the Thunder got for Paul George. And to look at, you know, the Pelicans didn't just get a ton of picks. They also got Brandon Ingram and Lonzo Ball and Josh Hart. And the Thunder didn't just get all those picks. They also got Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and a year of Gallinari. Like the Rockets traded a recent MVP and got nowhere near those packages. And yeah, I mean, look, the Nets picks, the first one is this year, is next year, 2022. By next year, they're still going to be really good. That's going to be a low pick. That's a bottom 10 pick. They're getting a swap. The first swap possibility is this year, which won't happen. There is no swap this year. The Nets will be better than the Rockets. So one swap's already off the board. The next swap is in 2023. I'd say that's probably unlikely that the Nets are going to be worse than the Rockets in 2023. So now you're down to the two swaps in 2025 and 2027. And the best picks are the ones in 2024 and 2026. And we should note in the Rockets' defense, in 2024, which is the second first rounder that definitely goes to them from the Nets, Durant is turning 36 that year, Harden 35 that year, and Kyrie 32. So there's a chance by 2024 that they start to get the payoff. But that's 3 years from now. Oladipo could be long gone, having left as a free agent this summer, potentially. So where are you? But I think the other thing that Raphael Stone said was the most revealing was this, Chris. He didn't say we're really excited about using those picks. He said people in this league like picks. So I think what he was signaling was we're going to package all this that we got and hope that somebody else finds it more valuable than Chris Mannix and Howard Beck do today. And that we're going to use those picks to get the next James Harden. Because that's how they got Harden, right? They had a bunch of assets.
Maybe you get a guy like Ben Simmons with those picks. I don't know. I get it. It's flexibility. We're seeing Oklahoma City with its 407 picks over the next 10 years. You know,
yeah.
New Orleans, you know, accumulating picks. It just feels like, and maybe it's just I'm judging it off fan bases who are always crazy, but it just feels like fan base are like, we got all these picks. We're going to wind up like Boston. Everybody thinks it's going to wind up like Boston, but I'm just saying Boston is such the exception to the rule. Like it just is. You know, there is a far greater likelihood that these picks are in the teens and 20s than they are inside the top five. Because as you said earlier, like, I fully expect Sean Marks, who will have first-round picks, some of these things are swap rights, he will have first-round picks to use to find the Dinwiddies and the Harrises and the Jared Allens and these guys that Caris LeVert, like these guys that were drafted, the teens and 20s, that have been proven to be highly effective players. I feel like he's going to find them. And look, it's one thing to maybe speculate that Kyrie and Kevin Durant could blow up because Kyrie has done that before. But I feel like Harden and Durant are just, unless things go really south, they're going to play together for the rest of their career. Like, I think they're going to wind up both signing extensions in Brooklyn. You know, Harden is now in a position where he can win and get paid. Durant can do the same thing. They never really wanted to be separated in the first place. People know this, but this wasn't a Durant-Westbrook type of situation with Harden. Like, they wanted to keep playing with each other. Like, they're good with that dynamic.
I'd be more concerned about age and mileage with those two, not about whether they want to stick together. They could finish their careers in Brooklyn, but it's more about age and mileage, and that's where the value of those picks comes in, if you're counting on the idea that they're just going to fall off a cliff at some point.
Yeah, I don't see the cliff. I can see them declining, but I think for the next 4 years – they're a contender. And from there, it's up to Sean Marks and the front office to flesh it out and supplement them with guys that can, you know, help them age gracefully, if you will, in Brooklyn. All right, let me finish with the feel-good story of the Western Conference, that being your Los Angeles Clippers, Howard Beck. That's right, the Clippers off to a hot start. Paul George playing like an early season MVP. Everybody in that Clippers locker room singing Kumbaya, saying the chemistry is better. There's leadership there. I'll put it simply. Are you buying the new look Clippers as a contender?
It's like first month of the season bingo, right? We're checking off boxes. Chemistry's better. Check. You know, career year in passing from fill in the blank. Check. You know, it's like it's everything is, you know, all the good stuff's falling into place. Never mind that a couple weeks ago they had the worst loss in franchise history to Dallas. They've recovered well, Chris, and there are good signs. I don't want to be overly facetious here. You know, like we've all gotten jaded, right? Like the Clippers, they were the darlings of everybody, including, I think, both of us, you know, last season before they fell off a cliff. We all thought they were championship material. They crash, and then we bounce to the other extreme. Now nobody believes in them. I'm somewhere in between. I'm like, I would be cautiously optimistic on their behalf. I think that the infusion of Batum and Ibaka does change things. These are good, solid veterans who also, as you know, they're both in the starting lineup now. They both can shoot the three. So now you can play five out. They're both versatile defenders. They're both good guys. They're both good locker room guys. They don't cause, you know, any trouble on a personality level, basketball wise. They don't need the ball. They're fine with whatever they get for the most part. So, you know, this is not to put it all on Montrezl Harrell or even on Doc Rivers. It's just more that they changed up the mixture a little bit, and Ty Lue is doing things a little bit differently too. So there's some actual substantive differences. It's not the exact same crew. I would also just say, as we sit here, you know, on Tuesday talking about this surge they're on, they've won four in a row, but it was against the Bulls, who are not great, the Pelicans, who have been up and down, the Kings, who are not great, and the Pacers, who had no Oladipo at that point, no LeVert because he won't be with them for a while because of a medical issue, and Miles Turner, who's now out. So the Pacers in that game started Edmund Sumner and Doug McDermott. So I don't want to place too much stock in a four-game.
I swear to God, I have no idea who Edmund Sumner is. You could have made that name up. Like you genuinely could have made that name up.
I might have. I might have imagined it. I don't even know if he exists. I couldn't tell you what he looks like. I don't know where he's from. Edmund sounds, that's kind of British. Edmund Sumner. I have no idea who that is either.
Sorry, but he's sorry, Edmund Pacers. Sumner. We'll have you on.
We'll make it up to you.
I am going to reserve judgment. The Clippers. I'm happy for Paul George, who is a great guy, and I don't think deserved the level of criticism that was handed him last year. Some of it,
agreed,
he brought it himself. I mean, when you call yourself Playoff P, you kind of invite, like you invite.
First of all, it's a terrible nickname. Whether it's true or not, whether it's accurate or not, it's just a Playoff P.
Isn't that one of those things that, like the second I read it that he had said it, I'm like, oh, that's not going to be good.
It doesn't exactly strike fear like the Mamba does. Hi, Mamba. I'm Playoff P.
But he's a good guy, and he's healthy this season. And look, he's not going to shoot 50% from three all season long, but he's capable of shooting in the 40s from 3-point range. So that's a positive. Two things that we don't know. One, what does it look like when they get punched in the mouth? Like what happens when they go through a 3-game losing streak in March? And certainly what happens if they go down 2-1 in a series? Like these are all things that we just can't learn about until they actually happen. And that's going to be a challenge for the Clippers. And part of the second thing is kind of part of the first. Like, where does the leadership come from? Like, this is not a team that is helmed by a LeBron, who is a proven playoff leader. You know, you go even over to the Eastern Conference, Jimmy Butler, a proven playoff leader. They have great players, championship-level players, specifically Kawhi Leonard, But Kawhi has not been the de facto leader of any of the teams he's been on. He's been the best player, but he hasn't necessarily been the heart and soul, the vocal leader of those teams. Wasn't in San Antonio, which was still Duncan's team up until the very end. And then you go to Toronto where you have Kyle Lowry, plus you have a whole bunch of guys that have been there forever anyway. So it's that team was kind of just close-knit in and of itself. And Paul George, who has been part of successful playoff teams, but he was on a Pacers team with David West and Danny Granger. Then he goes to Oklahoma City, and Russell Westbrook is the alpha on that team. Like, when the going gets tough, who in that locker room is going to bring it together? Like, that I wonder about as this season progresses.
I have wondered about that myself, Chris. I have said many times, I thought, you know, and I still believe, like, if they could somehow get Kyle Lowry, not just because he played with Kawhi before, but just because Lowry is exactly the kind of personality you need and the kind of leader you need, and because they could use an upgrade at the position, I don't know if he'll ever be available. And I don't know if they have the means to get it done. But yeah, like a Kyle Lowry facsimile, whoever that is, I think the Clippers could use. On the other hand, Ibaka has a respected voice and is a guy who can get fired up and a guy who I think will talk to guys and will hold guys accountable. I think Marcus Morris, while not as accomplished, has that kind of outgoing and forceful personality. I think that, you know, I don't think I'd look at Batum as some, you know, rally the troops guy, but he's a respected veteran who's been around and is respected. I think there's a different makeup that maybe won't be as big of an issue. Maybe it's not as big as of a concern. They badly needed that kind of leadership in the bubble and they didn't get it. Maybe this season they don't need it as badly. And maybe with that responsibility spread across some of the guys I just mentioned, maybe there's just less urgency for it. I don't know. I do know that the two stars are playing their butts off. They're both putting up great numbers, as you point out. Don't know if it's sustainable. They're both putting up career highs in assists. The ball's moving a lot more on this team, period. It's a lot less taking turns or hero ball, one-on-one stuff. Paul George is averaging 5.1 assists.
Real quick aside, Howard, like that I don't understand. Like, in Philly, the ball's moving more now. Like, what is happening that, like, in Philly, you're seeing, like, the playmaking move up. That's Doc Rivers there. And now you're seeing the playmaking happen. There's a lot of things I don't understand. This is a really weird start to the season. Like, a very weird start with numbers and with kind of, like, and you can't predict what's going to happen from game to game. There's a lot of weirdness.
This is the danger of the Twitter world that you and I live in and the weekly podcast world that we live in, because we are going to react in real time. And this season, more than ever, those real-time reactions are going to be very risky, because I don't know if we can count on anything that we've seen so far. There's been all these games that are being postponed, all these guys who are in protocols and quarantined, and just weird fluctuations within teams, like the short turnaround, the short training camps, everything. We are going to live to regret like 98% of what we say on this podcast, probably, at least in the first month or so.
No, I often do that, so it won't be that big a change. Howard, look forward to next week when we're discussing, you know, the Utah Jazz leading the Western Conference and all that comes with it. Appreciate it, man.
All right. We'll talk to you then.